world. The history of the sky for the last 35 years imprinted on the Harvard collection of photographs. Part 3. In the depths above. I saw in the stars a chance to observe phenomena beyond terrestrial scope. Nothing seemed impossible in those early days. We were going to understand everything tomorrow. Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, 1900 to 1979. Phillips Astronomer, Harvard College Observatory. There are two ways of spreading light, to be the candle or the mirror that reflects it. Edith Wharton, 1862 to 1937, author of The Age of Innocence and other acclaimed novels. Chapter 11. Shapley's Kilo Girl Hours. Mary H. Vann, an alumna of Cornell University, devoted her 1917-1918 term as the first Edward C. Pickering Fellow to an analysis of the new stars, or novae, that had shown up on the Harvard glass plates since 1887. Most of the 11 such stars had never been observed visually by anyone, or photographed by any other institution. Now, thanks to the abundance of plates and Miss Leavitt's completion of the North Polar sequence, Miss Vann had the necessary tools to assess the novae's changing magnitudes over time and create a light curve for each one. On June 8, 1918, shortly before she left the observatory to take up war work, a new nova erupted in the constellation Aquila, outshining all but the very brightest stars for several weeks. At magnitude negative 0.5, Nova Aquilae 1918 proved the brightest such sight since the invention of the telescope, but its photographic study fell to the second Pickering Fellow, Dorothy W. Block, a 1915 graduate of Hunter College in New York City. Unlike the Astronomical Fellowship of the Nantucket Mariah Mitchell Association, now permanently assigned to Margaret Harwood, the Pickering Fellowship entailed no Nantucket residency rule. The recipient was welcome to visit Miss Harwood on the island during the summer months, if she so chose, but the real reward consisted of research funding at Harvard through a typical fall to spring academic year. Miss Block devoted her allotted time in 1918 to 1919 to measuring the changing light of variable stars, several asteroids, and of course, the great new star in Aquila. In the spring, she also learned to photograph the stars, so that she often stood in for the regular assistant during the first part of the night. This experience helped her secure a job offer from the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, where she was about to become the first woman ever allowed to take photographs through its 40-inch telescope, the world's largest refractor. As Miss Block prepared to leave Cambridge, Henry Draper's niece, Antonia Maury, petitioned to become the next Pickering Fellow. At 53, the experienced Miss Maury was roughly twice the age of either Miss Vann or Miss Block. However, she met the crucial requirement of holding a college degree, Vassar, class of 1887, and had studied astronomy under the beloved Mariah Mitchell. With regard to Miss Maury, Lydia Hinchman of the Mariah Mitchell Association asked Annie Cannon in a letter of April 8, 1919, I have heard she is peculiar. Is that true? I also have heard she has a brilliant mind. I scarcely feel competent to give an opinion without seeing her. But it is for 1 year, and if you feel so disposed, you might try it. Miss Cannon chaired the selection committee, but Mrs. Hinchman was entitled and accustomed to offer advice. If her peculiarities are not to the front, I would try it. Miss Maury had resumed her on-again, off-again association with the Harvard Observatory in August 1918 by attending the American Astronomical Society meeting held there. It was her first meeting as an elected member of the organization. Pickering, who was then the Society's president, had invited Miss Morey to stay on in Cambridge as a voluntary associate researcher. Thus, with no prospect of salary, she rekindled her first love, the very close double stars known as spectroscopic binaries. Months later, following the director's death, Professor Bailey encouraged Miss Morey to take a paid position as assistant to John Stanley Plaskett at a brand new observatory in Victoria, British Columbia. But at this stage of her life, she could not readily relocate so far from anywhere she had ever called home. Miss Cannon and Miss Morey, close contemporaries, had overlapped in their careers at Harvard long enough to judge each other's character and quirks. Miss Cannon deemed her colleague entirely deserving of the fellowship opportunity, and Miss Morey gratefully accepted the $500 stipend. The first two parts of the revised and expanded Henry Draper catalog, published as Annals Volumes 91 and 92, made Harlow Shapley impatient for the third. "Can you predict when 93 will be distributed?" he inquired of Miss Cannon from his post at Mount Wilson on May 8, 1919. "It happens to be the most important of all to me. I am using your results to check my work on cluster structure, and the stars of the Southern Milky Way play an important role." By cluster structure, Shapley referred not to the distant globular clusters ringing the periphery of the Milky Way, but to what he termed the local cluster, meaning stars in the vicinity of the sun. Stars close enough to be described in the catalog according to their position, magnitude, and spectrum. Parts 1 and 2 of Miss Cannon's magnum opus had covered several longitudinal swaths of the 360-degree sky panorama, from 0 degrees, or the zero hour in astronomical parlance, to 90 degrees, the sixth hour. Shapley now needed the seventh and succeeding hours, yet to be revealed in the next installments, to continue his study of the organization of the solar neighborhood. Volume 93, Miss Cannon assured him, had already been set in type. But the bookbinders had gone on strike, and she could not say how long publication might be delayed by the settling of their grievances. Meanwhile, she satisfied Shapley by mailing him the unbound signatures. The observatory, even in Pickering's absence, was continuing to operate by his guiding principle. First, you gather all the information, then you give it away to those who crave it. "My very best thanks for your kindness in sending me proof sheets of the third volume of the Henry Draper catalog," Shapley wrote back. "I have been through it all and have obtained just the information I thought would be there relative to the form and extent of the local cluster." Shapley wanted more than one way to measure distances across the galaxy. The Cepheids had demonstrated their special powers as distance indicators. But Miss Leavitt's stars were few in number. Shapley thought the more numerous luminous stars belonging to spectral class B could also provide distance clues. B-type stars were generously scattered through the Milky Way, and their positions and magnitudes already well established through thousands of reliable measures, all collated in the Harvard catalogs. In general, the B stars shone some 200 times brighter than the sun. From Mount Wilson, Shapley could make out the spectra of B stars among distant clusters via the 60 and 100-inch telescopes. By the relative faintness of the remoter Bs, he was able to estimate their distance and thus employ them as alternate mileposts. Shapley thought the giant red stars could also be engaged as measuring aids, since they, too, populated both the globular clusters and the Milky Way. Many other researchers, pursuing other studies, echoed Shapley's clamoring for the remainder of the Henry Draper catalog. The later volumes, however, faced a problem more serious than labor disputes, namely, lack of funds. "The prompt publication of all this material is necessary in order to complete the great life work of the late director. Solon Bailey stressed in his first report as acting director. He projected the cost at $15,000 beyond the income of the observatory. While seeking funding, he honored and tallied the urgent requests from individual astronomers for particular spectra. Hundreds of such queries arrived every month. Edward Pickering had told President Lowell in 1910 that he considered Professor Bailey the only member of his staff capable of taking over the observatory as acting or permanent director. After Pickering's death in 1919, Bailey's assumption of responsibility had proceeded seamlessly. But the Harvard administration made no move to confirm him as the fifth director. George R. Agassiz, a member of the visiting committee and patron of the observatory, counseled Lowell to go for new blood and real distinction. Not even Bailey considered himself, at age 65, the right person to lead the observatory into the future. He pictured a younger man taking charge, someone like Harlow Shapley of Mount Wilson, or better yet, Shapley's mentor, Henry Norris Russell of Princeton, only 42 years old and widely regarded as a brilliant thinker. On learning of his eligibility, the cautious Russell raised an eyebrow. He half suspected that Abbott Lowell would have appointed his own distinguished brother, the Mars expert, as director, if only Percival Lowell were still alive. The founder of the Lowell Observatory, however, had passed away at Flagstaff in 1916. Pickering's brother, William, on the other hand, though not in the running for the directorship, remained at large in Mandeville. Should Russell accept Harvard's overtures, he would inherit William along with the other staff members. And that thought gave him pause. William seemed obsessed with Martian canals, claimed to have detected water on the moon, and was known to be calculating the whereabouts of a planet beyond Neptune. Neither Miss Cannon nor Miss Leavitt, being female and 50-plus, was eligible for the directorship, nor did either wish the position for herself. Miss Leavitt, never physically strong, had been forced to leave the big house on Garden Street when it was sold after her uncle, Erasmus Leavitt, died in 1916. She had moved into a rooming house. But when her widowed mother came back east, the two of them took an apartment together on Linnaean Street, close to the observatory. Miss Cannon, still living happily with her older half-sister, Ella Cannon Marshall, continued to accrue honors at home and abroad. The University of Delaware awarded her a Doctor of Science degree in 1918, claiming her as a distinguished native daughter of the Diamond State. In 1919, her English friend, Herbert Hall Turner, the civilian professor of astronomy at Oxford, sought to raise her standing in the Royal Astronomical Society. "The other day," Turner wrote to her on May 13th, "I proposed your name as an associate of the RAS, on the same footing as men. I hoped you would regard it as a new recognition, and that by thus transferring our one honorary member, we should remove the last remaining trace of the previous disability of women. But the council disagreed with me, and thought you would prefer your present lonely isolation as a greater honor." Thanks to a 1915 change in the society's charter, women could now be elected fellows, if British subjects, and associates, if foreigners. Miss Cannon felt content to retain her honorary status. But she took Turner up on another of his suggestions in the spring of 1919, regarding the Mariah Mitchell Association. "It might be possible, let us say as a friendly act at the present moment of great events and important new departures," Turner thought, "to assign one of the fellowships to an Englishwoman. I need scarcely point to the advantages which such action would have, both in encouraging women's work generally, in cementing friendly relations between the two nations, and in creating a new form of recognition." Miss Kennan's committee had already decided on Miss Morey for the coming year. But the members heard in Turner's words an echo of Professor Pickering's international spirit, and promised to search overseas for the next Pickering Fellow. Harlow Shapley's Big Galaxy, as he described it in 1918, filled the known universe. It was so immense that it subsumed everything else. Globular clusters rimmed it, nebulous forms fit inside it, and the Magellanic Clouds hung from it as appendages. But numerous astronomers refused to be bound by it. Unlike Shapley, they viewed the Milky Way as one galaxy among many, a single island universe in a vast archipelago. Shapley, too, had ascribed to the island universe theory up until 1917. But once he exploded the size of the Milky Way to titanic proportions through his distant assessments of the globular clusters, he changed his mind. The enormity of the Milky Way ruled out the existence of other comparable galaxies. Nothing substantive surrounded it, Shapley thought, other than dross and empty space. Deciding the truth of the island universe matter depended on determining the placement of the spiral nebulae. These pinwheels of celestial light had been sighted by the thousands, beginning in the mid-19th century when William Parsons of Ireland and his friends first viewed their distinctive forms through the huge reflecting telescope known as the Leviathan of Parsonstown. The spirals, as they were called for short, looked as though they might be whirlpools of incandescent gas, or whirlwinds of interstellar dust, or whirls of stars. It was difficult to say without knowing their distances. Some astronomers saw each spiral's bright center and trailing arms as a new solar system of a sun and planets in the making. Those who viewed the spirals as full-blown external galaxies, however, divined in their coiled forms a likely blueprint for the Milky Way. George Ellery Hale thought the disagreement over the spirals an apt subject for a public debate. When he proposed the topic to the National Academy of Sciences late in 1919, he also named general relativity, which had been much in the news, as an alternate theme possibility. The idea of relativity put forth by Albert Einstein in 1915 was changing the nature of space from a passive container of the stars to a fabric warped by the stars' presence. Einstein's German roots and the course of the Great War at first slowed the theory's acceptance. But the English pacifist Arthur Stanley Eddington tested its validity during the May 29, 1919 total solar eclipse, which he observed from the African island of Principe. It was an eclipse expedition even Pickering would have approved. The stunning results, announced in November 1919, demonstrated that light waves indeed felt the effect of gravity, and by the amount Einstein had predicted. The erudite Eddington expressed the findings in poetry as well as prose, borrowing the rhythm of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. O leave the wise our measures to collate. One thing at least is certain, light has weight. One thing is certain and the rest debate. Light rays, when near the sun, do not go straight. Given a choice between relativity and the galaxy, the Academy Secretary, solar astronomer Charles Greeley Abbott, expressed a strong preference. As to relativity, I must confess that I would rather have a subject in which there would be a half dozen members of the Academy competent enough to understand at least a few words of what the speakers were saying, if we had a symposium upon it. I pray to God that the progress of science will send relativity to some region of space beyond the fourth dimension, from whence it may never return to plague us. Having thus settled the discussion topic in favor of spirals, Abbott invited Shapley to present his monogalaxy idea, and Heber D. Curtis of the Lick Observatory to argue the case for multiple galaxies. The event took place in Washington, D.C. on the evening of April 26, 1920. Shapley, who was known to behave at times in brash and overconfident ways, withered even before he took the podium. Not only did he fear being upstaged by a smooth public speaker of Curtis's stature, but he had learned well ahead of showtime that Agassiz from the Harvard Observatory's visiting committee would be in the audience to judge his fitness for the director slot. Unfortunately, Shapley pitched his prepared talk at a level appropriate for intelligent laymen, and it impressed no one. Speaking first, he took several minutes to explain the meaning of a light year as the distance that light traveled in a year. "Now that we have a satisfactory unit of sidereal distance," he said, reading from his script, "let us go rambling about the universe." He led a pictorial tour through star clusters near and far, including those seen in Orion and Hercules, but promised, "I shall not impose upon you the dreary technicalities of the methods of determining the distance of globular clusters." He sidestepped the spirals, except to stress how little was actually known about them. "I prefer to believe that they are not composed of stars at all, but are truly nebulous objects. In a word, diffuse." "Even if the spirals are stellar," he conceded in closing, "they are not comparable in size with our stellar system, the Milky Way." Curtis then came forward, intent on reducing Shapley's gargantuan galaxy to about 1/10 its grandeur. To the apparent size, that is, of a typical spiral. He laid out abundant arguments in favor of the spirals being galaxies, including evidence for the Milky Way's own spiral shape. "Examination of spirals' spectra," Curtis said, "suggested that many more of them were made of stars than of free-flowing gas. In recent years, about a dozen spirals had lit up with new star flare-ups, such as the 1895 nova that the late Wilhelmina Fleming discovered in the Centaurus spiral. Curtis interpreted the presence of these novae as proof that spirals contained at least some stars, although opponents of the island universe idea argued that novae arose when spirals collided with stars. Certainly, spirals were on the move. Their spectra indicated tremendous speeds in the line of sight, as though most of them were rushing away from the sun. Curtis saw these fantastic velocities as further testimony to the spiral's extragalactic location, since no stars within the Milky Way moved as rapidly. Curtis made all his points forcefully, and afterward boasted justly to his family that he had triumphed in the debate." The face-to-face confrontation ended when the auditorium emptied that night. But the question of the spirals remained undecided. Shapley and Curtis continued their contest via correspondence over the ensuing months, as they framed their presentations for publication in the Bulletin of the National Research Council. They traded drafts and weighed the worth of competing claims, but neither could win the other over to his side. While Shapley waited to hear whether Harvard would hire him, Curtis accepted the directorship of the Allegheny Observatory and moved from California to Pennsylvania. Those two states, California and Pennsylvania, had joined Massachusetts, Missouri, and 31 others by the summer of 1920 in ratifying the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. One more state sanction was still needed before women nationwide gained the right to vote. On August 18th, during a special session in the Tennessee House of Representatives, the measure narrowly won support and became law. Miss Cannon went to the polls at the first opportunity on September 7th to cast her ballot in the primary. She marked November 2nd, 1920, as Election Tuesday in her diary. "Gray day and cold. Women out in force. I went with the Baileys at 10:30. Voting is very easy." That evening, she stopped on Boston Common to get the latest election bulletin and absorbed the general enthusiasm for Senator Warren G. Harding of Ohio as the 29th President of the United States. In England that autumn, the fourth Pickering Fellow, Miss A. Grace Cook of Stowmarket, stayed outdoors for hours every night to observe meteors, commonly known as falling or shooting stars. Seated in a deck chair, Miss Cook scanned the skies for sudden moving lights that signaled the entry of a bit of space rock or comet dust into Earth's atmosphere. When a meteor appeared, she clicked her stopwatch to time its flight, and with her other hand held aloft a straight, thin wand about 5 feet long, aligned with the intruder's path. In a few seconds of visibility, she memorized the meteor's changing magnitude compared with that of the stars it passed from apparition to disappearance, and then jotted down her accumulated data. In daytime, she could plot the several pathways on a celestial globe to find the radiant or point of origin for a given meteor shower. And although the wet English weather often thwarted her, she also observed other naked-eye phenomena, such as aurorae and lunar halos, and hunted comets through the small telescope she purchased with her stipend. On February 9, 1921, after receiving the second half of her grant money from Professor Turner of Oxford, she wrote to Miss Cannon, "He seems to understand what a boon such a gift is to an isolated worker, and one who can only set aside a small sum yearly to devote to science. It is like a lovely dream come true. I only hope I have made the very best use of it. I have done my best to do so." After months of reclusive work, she added, "Most of my astronomical friends imagine I am in America at Harvard. They think the fellowship was a residential one." Miss Cannon had known all along how things would turn out. The very first time she met Harlow Shapley, during his 1914 visit to Cambridge as a Princeton graduate student, she told him, "Young man, I know what you're going to do. You're going to be the director of the Harvard Observatory." Then she laughed. Shapley remembered her laugh years later as something prophetic or possibly psychic, when Harvard at last offered him the job. "Dr. Shapley arrived," Miss Cannon wrote in her diary on March 28, 1921. The next day she had a long talk with him and decided, "I like him. So young, so clear, so brilliant." In fact, the 35-year-old Shapley had not yet been named director. He was technically on probation, with the vague title of observer. Given his substellar performance in the scale of the universe debate and the hubris with which he put forth his daring theories, the untried new leader had been given just 1 year to prove himself worthy of Harvard's trust. If he should clash with the university or the observatory, then George Ellery Hale would gladly take him back at Mount Wilson. Shapley himself considered the Cambridge relocation a permanent one. He spent several weeks that spring preparing the director's residence to receive his family, while Martha and the three children, Mildred, Willis, and Alan, visited relatives in Kansas City. On his first day at the observatory, Shapley stopped by Miss Cannon's office and asked to see the spectrum of SW Andromedae, a faint variable that had aroused his interest. She called out to an assistant to retrieve a particular plate, identifying it by a 5-digit number catalogued in her prodigious memory. To Shapley's amazement, the girl went to the stacks and got the plate, and SW Andromedae was on it. With Miss Cannon, Shapley initiated an investigation into the distribution of the stars of different spectral types, tallying the number in each class over a wide range of magnitudes. Pickering had attempted a similar statistical analysis decades before. With only 1/20th the amount of data Shapley now found at his disposal in the Harvard plate collection. The brick building held the whole sky captive inside a hive of industry. Luckily, Harvard College was swarming with cheap assistants. Shapley said of his early days as observer, "That was how we got things done." At Mount Wilson, he had grown accustomed to making his own measurements of photographic plates. At Harvard, he invented the term girl hour for the time spent by young and not so young women at various plate measuring and computing tasks. Some jobs, he quipped, even took several kilogirl hours. Surely the ongoing preparation of the Henry Draper catalog figured among the more laborious. The fourth volume had been printed before Shapley's arrival, with the help of donations from observatory friends James and Margaret Jewett, and members of the American Association of Variable Star Observers. Now veteran computer Florence Cushman was reading Miss Cannon's proofs for volumes 5 and 6. Shapley passed over the prim Ida Woods, who had served as Pickering's unofficial secretary, and instead selected the younger, more affable Arville Billy Walker to assist him with his correspondence. He straightaway engaged Miss Leavitt in a study of the different types of variables in the Magellanic clouds. Together, they demonstrated that the clouds contained short-period cluster-type variables, in addition to Cepheids. This was just the confirmation Shapley needed to shore up the great distances he had derived for the globular clusters, the distances on which his enlargement of the galaxy depended. Further support for Shapley's big galaxy reached him in the spring of 1921 from his Mount Wilson friend and colleague, Adrian van Manen. After comparing plates of the same spirals taken on dates years apart, van Manen tied their swirling shapes to what he perceived as a real spinning motion. The spirals not only spun, van Manen argued, but also their rapid rates of rotation suggested they resided within the Milky Way. At distances no greater than a few thousand light years from the sun, their spin pace remained within reason. If removed to the distance of an external galaxy, however, then the millimeters he had marked on the plates would translate into many times more kilometers traveled through space and accelerate the rotation to exceed the speed of light. Since nothing could move faster than light, van Manen's measurements of the spiral nebulae reduced the island universes to absurdity in Shapley's eyes. "Congratulations on the nebulous results," Shapley cheered to van Manen on June 8th. "Between us, we have put a crimp in the island universes, it seems. You by bringing the spirals in, and I by pushing the galaxy out. We are indeed clever, we are." Shapley introduced himself to the wider Harvard community by offering a colloquium on astronomy, in which he tried hard to improve his performance over the previous year's debate in Washington. This time, he told jokes. Former President Charles Eliot, who attended the talk, advised Shapley afterward that he need not embroider his grand subject with gratuitous humor. In his attempt to win new friends for astronomy from Cambridge and Boston, Shapley instituted a series of open nights, inviting the public to hear a non-technical lecture and peer through some of the telescopes. Admission was free, but interested visitors needed to register for tickets, since the observatory could not accommodate large crowds, and many sought entry. Pleased with the response, Shapley also planned to set aside separate nights for welcoming pupils from the local schools, as well as groups of Boys and Girls Club members. In the fall, when Hale inquired whether he should anticipate Shapley's return to Pasadena, Lowell said Harvard meant to keep him in the East. University officials had voted to appoint Shapley as permanent director on the very day Hale's letter arrived, October 31st, 1921. As soon as Shapley relaxed into his leadership role, he awoke to the menace lurking in Mandeville. William Pickering released his latest research results in popular astronomy, and newspapers quickly picked up the Jamaica-based Harvard professor's account of life on the moon. William reported vegetation sprouting on the lunar surface in rapid, regular cycles, with abundant water and occasional steam emanating from craters. "We find, therefore," William asserted, speaking for himself, a living world at our very doors, where life in some respects resembles that on Mars, but utterly unlike anything on our own planet, a world which the astronomical profession in general for the past 50 years has systematically neglected. William was currently on sabbatical in Europe, a perquisite that Bailey had won for him from the Harvard Corporation. Bailey had tolerated William's excesses, and even gained him a small salary increase, the first raise in William's 30-plus years on the observatory staff. "It seems to me that one can safely accept most of his observed phenomena," Bailey said in William's defense. "The difficulty comes in the interpretation." Shapley had no such patience. He planned to terminate Harvard's connection with the Woodlawn Observatory in Mandeville the moment William reached the age for mandatory retirement. At the same time, but with a very different emotion, Shapley faced losing Miss Leavitt, whom he valued as one of the most important women ever to touch astronomy. The discoverer of the period luminosity law was dying of cancer. "One of the few decent things I have done," Shapley wrote in his memoir, "was to call on her deathbed. It made life so much different," friends said, "that the director came to see her." Miss Cannon called often on Miss Leavitt toward the end, taking small gifts and marking each decline in her diary. December 12th, rainy day pouring at night. Henrietta passed away at 10:30 p.m. On the 14th, Miss Cannon attended Henrietta's funeral at Chapel of First Congregational Church, 2 p.m., coffin covered with flowers. Solon Bailey withdrew gracefully from the helm of the Harvard Observatory. In order to give the new director room to maneuver, Bailey offered to return to Peru for another sojourn at Arequipa. Along with his wife, Ruth, he anticipated a fruitful reunion with the Southern Star clusters. Their son, Irving, now a Harvard professor of botany and married to Margaret Harwood's sister, Helen, did not accompany them this time. However, Miss Cannon did, encouraged by Shapley to take her own plates of the Milky Way for later classification of stars fainter than ninth magnitude. She kept a close lyrical account of her travels. "The skyline of New York faded away in a drapery of moist snow on March 1, 1922, when the Grace liner Santa Luisa steamed out for Panama, Peru, and Chile. It took 2 weeks for the ship to reach Mollendo, the nearest port to Arequipa via the Panama Canal. Miss Cannon marveled at the Gatun and Miraflores locks, and even more at the sights above. Epsilon and Iota Carinae, Kappa and Delta Velorum. How eagerly I gazed upon these stars, for my very first astronomical investigation concerned the spectra of bright southern stars, never before visible to my eye." Progress had altered the port of Mollendo since the perilous offloading of the Bruce telescope in 1896. Miss Cannon was forced to bid the ship's company a hasty farewell, for a novel method of landing passengers is customary at that port. A chair swung out from shore by a steam crane is let down into the tender, and seating himself, the passenger is quickly transferred to the Mollendo dock. After that, one expected novelties at every turn. And they came. Still 104 miles were we from Arequipa, with wonders all the way. They traversed the desert and beheld the Andes. At the Arequipa railway station, a motor car awaited to take them the final 2 miles to the observatory. Such a drive through colorful Arequipa, the Cairo of South America, over the Chile River and into the town of Yanahuara, where streets are so narrow that pedestrians crowded against the walls of houses to avoid being run down. The Arequipa station had been shuttered in November 1918, When the then supervisor, Elsie Blanchard, covered the telescope lenses and left to enlist in the armed forces. Even before the United States entered the war, decreased financial support had diminished the site's productivity, and the risks of shipping glass plates through war-troubled waters had grown prohibitive. Juan E. Muñiz, the longtime caretaker, watched over the locked, deserted station until peace reopened it. Frank E. Hinckley, a veteran of two previous Arequipa assistance ships, took charge of the place in 1919, aided by the faithful Muñiz. Since Hinckley's departure in September 1921, Muñiz had single-handedly managed the building and equipment maintenance, the meteorological observations, and the taking of more than 1,000 new pictures of the sky. Observing in the transparent air at Arequipa revealed so much depth and detail that Miss Cannon had the sense she was gazing up into a live, long-exposure photograph. She learned to take her own plates with the various instruments, including the unwieldy 24-inch Bruce telescope. Each plate I secured was to me very precious. After developing and drying, I examined them as soon as possible, searching for new or unusual objects. One such object proved to be a new long-period variable, another a nova. "I expect to be an athlete when I return to old Cambridge," she wrote sharply. "For the running of the 13-inch requires turning a heavy dome, mounting ladders big and little, and all sorts of things, which Mr. Muñiz declared I could not do, for it was not woman's work. I can do it all, however, except get good plates of faint spectra." A spry 58, she often walked the 5 miles to and from Arequipa, over the worst roads you ever saw, in the afternoon, and then worked 5 or more hours at the telescopes. "But it is great fun and does not tire me at all. Indeed, it has been on clear nights so beautiful at midnight that I hated to go to bed." In addition to the pleasure of these pursuits, Miss Cannon enjoyed seeing a side of Bailey in Simpatica Arequipa that he rarely revealed in Cambridge. A certain New England reserve and shyness, she noticed, melted away under the tropical Peruvian sky. Early in May, while the Baileys and Miss Cannon were thus occupied, most other astronomers reunited in Rome for the first General Assembly of the new International Astronomical Union, the post-war incarnation of George Ellery Hale's old Solar Union. The meeting planned for 1916 had been scuttled by the conflict. But in 1919, scientists from many fields and 12 countries met in Brussels to forge new partnerships. The IAU emerged as one of the first of these forward-looking groups, and was personally welcomed into the world by King Albert of Belgium. Although thousands of miles from the 1922 gathering, Miss Cannon was well represented in Rome. Henry Norris Russell, the chairman of the current Committee on Stellar Classification, had invited her participation early in 1919, and she had kept up a steady exchange of ideas with her fellow members since that time. Russell's formal report showed that Miss Cannon's system survived the discussions intact, strengthened by several additions useful to specialists in spectroscopy. For example, an S category had been introduced for a new class of red stars, thus lengthening the entrenched mnemonic to, "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me right now, sweetheart." Also, the prefix of a lowercase c, a remnant from Miss Morey's more elaborate classification system, could now legitimately be placed before any capital letter to identify a star with markedly narrow, sharp lines. This C had proven its usefulness and won its rightful place in the stellar nomenclature. Similarly, the passage of 10 years had underscored the importance of distinguishing between giant stars and dwarf stars, allowing the admission of G or D prefixes where appropriate. Solon Bailey, as chairman of the IAU Committee on Variable Stars, had written the committee's report, but requested that Shapley read it for him at Rome. The report outlined a cooperative future. France, Italy, and other countries would henceforth coordinate observations, following the successful model of amateurs and professionals working together in the American Association of Variable Star Observers. Harlow and Martha Shapley had vacillated through the early months of 1922 as to whether they could make the trip to Rome. Both their boys, Willis and Alan, fell dangerously ill that winter with pneumonia, and for a while the parents feared Willis would not pull through. When the crisis passed, Shapley still questioned the wisdom of a long absence from his duties. Once he and Martha decided to go, however, he influenced the travel plans of other attending astronomers and made sure to sail aboard the same ship as the Russells. He even convinced Arthur Stanley Eddington to move up the Royal Astronomical Society's centenary celebration from June to May for the convenience of American foreign associates already abroad. Between the ending of the IAU meeting on May 10th and the start of the RAS events in London on the 29th, Shapley gave talks in the Netherlands on galactic structure and visited German observatories in Potsdam, Munich, Bergedorf, and Babelsberg. In mid-June, seated once again at Pickering's revolving desk in the observatory, Shapley bragged to George Agassiz and the visiting committee of the trip's successes. "At the centenary of the RAS, I talked about the work now being done at Harvard, and also made the principal address at a special meeting of the British Astronomical Association. At the Rome International Meeting, the Harvard Observatory astronomers were elected to 11 memberships on 8 of the 26 commissions, a recognition exceeded only by Mount Wilson among the American observatories. And my personal memberships naturally exceed those of any other American astronomer, because of the wide range of interest at Harvard, and were equaled only by those of the Astronomer Royal." In other words, Agassiz should forget he ever doubted Shapley's competence to direct the Harvard College Observatory. Chapter 12. Miss Payne's Thesis. One might have expected Harlow Shapley to regret leaving the giant telescopes and ideal viewing conditions of Mount Wilson for life in a cloudy East Coast metropolis. Once settled in Cambridge, however, Shapley found he preferred his new role as observatory director to the rigors of making observations. "Observing was always very hard work for me," he conceded in his memoir. "I suffered quite a bit those long cold nights. I suppose I didn't get as much sleep in the daytime as I needed, for I was running around observing ants in the bushes." At Harvard, he befriended his longtime correspondent, myrmecologist William Morton Wheeler, to whom he had mailed many vials of ants for expert identification. In the faculty dining club, Shapley, who had inherited Pickering's title as the Payne Professor of Practical Astronomy, hobnobbed with professors from other fields and honed his ideas about astronomy education. Although senior observatory staff members Solon Bailey, Edward King, and Willard Gerrish all went by the title of professor, they neither held doctoral degrees nor taught Harvard courses. The one man who did teach elementary astronomy at the university, Robert Wheeler Wilson, did not associate himself with the observatory. Indeed, as Shapley pointed out, the observatory was not involved in instruction, but in the production of knowledge. He determined to expand its mission to include the training of graduate students. "Had a graduate astronomy program been in place at Harvard," Shapley said, "President Lowell would not have needed to import a Missourian fresh from California as Pickering's successor." Shapley well knew, from his own years as Henry Norris Russell's mentee at Princeton, that graduate students require graduate student fellowships in order to survive. The only fellowship money on hand at the Harvard Observatory was the Edward C. Pickering Astronomical Fellowship for Women. Ergo, Shapley looked to the women's colleges as his sources of graduate students. In late January 1923, after much searching, he welcomed Adelaide Ames as his first recruit. Miss Ames had attained graduation with honors, summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Vassar College the previous June. An army officer's daughter, she had lived in the Philippines and traveled through China, India, Egypt, and Italy before attending high school in Washington, D.C. At Vassar, she had taken courses in integral calculus, molecular physics and heat, and physical optics and spectroscopy, which she documented by taping the catalog descriptions into her Harvard application letter. She had also reported and edited the Vassar Miscellany News, hoping to parlay that experience into a career. For months in the summer and fall of 1922, Miss Ames had tried but failed to land a job as a journalist. Now she was turning to astronomy as her second choice. Shapley had followed a similar path. Already a seasoned newspaper man when he entered college in 1907, he had chosen the University of Missouri on account of its much-touted new school of journalism. At enrollment, however, when he learned that the journalism school opening had been delayed a year, he signed up instead for astronomy, physics, and classics courses. Despite his proficiency in Latin, he soon abandoned the classics for the activities and instruments of the campus observatory. In the absence of a Pickering Fellow for 1921 to 1922, bank interest had accrued on the fund, enabling Shapley to increase the dollar amount of the award. He offered Miss Ames $650 to see her through two semesters of computation and research based on the glass plates, plus credit toward a Radcliffe graduate degree. He also agreed, now that she had made up her mind to become an astronomer, to let her start her academic year immediately, in the spring term, rather than make her wait until fall. When she arrived, he put her to work on one aspect of his pet problem, the distance and distribution of the stars in the Milky Way. Using plates from Arequipa, Miss Ames assessed and reassessed the apparent brightness of some 200 southern stars. She also estimated their true or absolute magnitude from the intensity of selected lines in their spectra. Then she computed the differences between the apparent and absolute luminosity, with allowance for probable errors, to establish the stars' distances. Miss Ames, the new Pickering Fellow, is hard at it on absolute magnitudes, Miss Cannon noted in her diary on Monday, February 12th. Later that week, she reiterated, "Miss Ames, the new fellow, is taking hold very well." In March, Miss Cannon mentioned in a letter to Caroline Furness at Vassar, the newcomer's former professor, that Miss Ames is proving efficient and industrious and appears greatly interested in the problem of absolute magnitudes. By May, a Harvard circular reported the distances of 233 southern stars under the joint authorship of Harlow Shapley and Adelaide Ames. With this new form of acknowledgement, Shapley out-Pickeringed Pickering. The late director had written virtually all the circulars himself, always giving credit to others in the text, but signing off at the end in his own name. Shapley made the researcher's bylines prominent on the first page, right under the announcement's title. A new graduate student classmate for Miss Ames, Cecilia Helena Payne, came to Cambridge in the autumn of 1923. All the way from Cambridge, England. Miss Payne traced her interest in astronomy to the 1919 eclipse in Principe that had proved Einstein right. Although not a participant in the expedition, she had heard its leader, Arthur Stanley Eddington, lecture about it during her first year at Newnham, a women-only college of Cambridge University where she was studying botany, physics, and chemistry. She experienced his talk as a thunderclap, she said. He so inspired her that she returned to her dormitory room and wrote down his every word from memory, after which feat, and feeling her world transformed, she did not sleep for three nights. When she met the great Eddington during an open house at the University Observatory, she avowed her desire to become an astronomer. He encouraged her by saying that he could see no insuperable objection. Other professors predicted at best an amateur status in the field for any English woman, coupled with a paid position as a schoolmarm. Still, Miss Payne persevered. She added courses in astronomy to her curriculum, studied the professional journals, learned how to compute orbits, reopened Newnham's long unused observatory, and with its small telescope began to explore the sky. In 1922, a classmate took Miss Payne to London to hear Harlow Shapley address the Royal Astronomical Society. She already knew Shapley's name from papers he had written at Mount Wilson about globular clusters, but in person his youth and style surprised her. "He spoke with extraordinary directness," Miss Payne recorded, "conveyed the reality of the cosmic picture in masterly strokes. Here was a man who walked with the stars and spoke of them as familiar friends." Upon being introduced afterward to the speaker, she told him she wished to work for him in America, and Shapley humored her with his reply, "When Miss Cannon retires, you can succeed her." Surely he was joking, but Miss Payne seized the comment as reason to hope. She completed her college courses the following year, and then, egged on by Shapley's promise of a Pickering Fellowship, she rounded up other prizes and grants to finance her move abroad. Shapley stationed Miss Payne on the second floor of the brick building at Henrietta Leavitt's old desk. There, Miss Payne, free at last from the Victorian strictures that had bound her since childhood, spent her new American-style independence on overwork. She arrived early at the observatory, stayed late, and sometimes failed to quit the place for days at a stretch. Rumor soon had it that the ghost of Miss Leavitt haunted the plate stacks and caused her lamp to burn through the night. But it was only Miss Payne, toiling till all hours. "She is a healthy, but not really strong person," Miss Payne's widowed mother appealed to Shapley by letter from London, "and lives largely on her enthusiasms, and while I delight to think of her doing the work she loves, I cannot help being anxious at times lest she should not allow herself the necessary rest." Miss Payne's adoptive mother hens at Harvard, Annie Cannon and Antonia Maury, shared Emma Pertz Payne's concerns and vowed to protect her daughter. Nor were they alone in doting on Miss Payne. Professor Edward King, still the master of Harvard's photography, taught her the idiosyncrasies of the several telescopes. The night assistant, Frank Bowie, helped her develop her plates and also informed her that the coordinates of any new comet, its right ascension and declination, might pay off handsomely if played in the local underworld's numbers game. The tall, shy, ungainly Miss Payne and the lovely, engaging Miss Ames became fast inseparable friends. Also, bridge partners at cards with Miss Cannon and her sister. Their closeness caused people to call the two students the Heavenly Twins. Between themselves, they affectionately referred to Shapley as the Dear Director, or simply, the DD. They liked the way he took the stairs two at a time, and the casual cheerfulness with which he heartened the underpaid female employees, often saying, "I think I could do this, so I'm sure you can." Miss Payne admitted to Miss Ames that she fairly worshipped the DD, that she might even be willing to die for him. Nevertheless, when Shapley suggested that Miss Payne carry on Miss Leavitt's work in photometry, she demurred. She preferred, she said, to pursue her own research agenda, applying the new theories of atomic structure and quantum physics to the analysis of stellar spectra. No one at the Harvard Observatory had yet attempted such an investigation. No one possessed the background to undertake it. But Miss Payne hailed from Newnham College and the famed Cavendish Laboratory of Cambridge University, a place peopled with pioneers in these nascent fields. The Cavendish was home to Sir J.J. Thompson, recipient of the 1906 Nobel Prize in Physics for his discovery of the electron. Thompson's disciple, Ernest Rutherford, whom Miss Payne described as a towering blonde giant with a booming voice, was the discoverer and first explorer of the atomic nucleus, and also the 1908 Nobel laureate in chemistry. During Miss Payne's student days at the Cavendish, she had learned the complex architecture of the Bohr atom directly from Niels Bohr, the 1922 Nobelist in physics. Although none of Bohr's lectures, which he delivered in a heavy Danish accent, ever lodged in Miss Payne's memory the way Eddington's relativity talk had stuck, she took good notes and saved them for later reference. Shapley gave Miss Payne permission to do as she pleased, with unfettered access to the glass plate collection. Suddenly fearful of handling the precious materials, she worried aloud, "What if I should break one of the plates?" In that case, he assured her with his typical lightness, she could keep the pieces. Solon and Ruth Bailey had returned to Peru in March 1922, with every expectation of remaining at the Southern Observatory for a period of several years. Their plans changed of necessity, however, when, within weeks of Miss Kennan's October departure, Mrs. Bailey suffered a stroke. It affected the left side of her brain, disturbing her speech and causing a partial paralysis on her right side. The dutiful Bailey tended to her with advice from local physicians and the help of a maid servant. He sent reports of Ruth's convalescence north, along with the plates he continued making of the large Magellanic cloud. Shapley, sympathetic to the couple's plight, sought to relieve them of responsibility at Arequipa, and looked to Edward King and his wife Kate as possible replacements. King, 62 years old, was Bailey's lifelong friend, eminently skilled and altogether willing, but doctors at the Harvard Medical School deemed him unfit for hard work at high altitude. In March 1923, Margaret Harwood of the Nantucket Observatory went to Arequipa to aid the Baileys. She took photographs through the Bruce telescope for Solon, and gave Ruth the benefit of her post-war experience with the home service of the American Red Cross. "I enjoy the work here very much," she wrote Shapley in June. "I now work with the Bruce the second half of the night. The dome works easily enough, and so does the telescope. This is a lovely spot. So far, I have found only three kinds of ants, and they do not look very unlike New Englanders, but you may know better when you see the specimens." By August, Mrs. Bailey, still unable to speak or write clearly, was advised to go home, as the chances for her full recovery looked better at sea level. She went to stay with her son and daughter-in-law in Cambridge until her husband could join her. Shapley's ongoing search for a new southern director led him to the Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin, where Dorothy Block, the second Pickering Fellow, had found employment after leaving Harvard. At Yerkes, Miss